Hello, welcome back to Making It Real, a podcast by TKS that follows our alumni all around the world. I'm your host, Isabella, from the 2018 Toronto cohort, and I am so excited to share these conversations, the insights, the tech, the problems that we talk about. So without further ado, let's go make it real. All right. Hi, we're back here with another TKS podcast. Today I'm talking with Adam, who's from TKS New York. If you don't know me, my name is Isabella. I'm from the TKS Toronto 2019 cohort, and right now I'm studying and living abroad in Asia, interested in biotech and the future there.
Yes, very nice intro. And what's good, everyone? I'm Adam. I'm TKS 2020, I guess that would make me. All I know is I'm the year after Izzy. I did AI and TKS. I went to UPenn after, and I'm on gap year now in SF working on a company called Third Web, which is a Web3 company.
Yeah, that's awesome. What about we start with what it meant growing up in a place where Penn was the goal or one of the best universities to go to, and then taking a moment and stepping away from that? What made you see the opportunity in Third Web? Were there pressures taking you, you know, maybe not doing, taking the leap? So maybe talk a little bit about that decision there.
Yeah, I think for me, I've never really idolized college. I think it was always just one of the next steps that makes sense for what I wanted to do. Definitely Penn and Ivy Leagues and stuff get idolized a lot. But I think for me, I was never really focused on that. The reputation is basically purely just built on like the clout and what it can get you job-wise. But as far as actual learning, I think there's obviously a lot of different paths that get you the same amount, or if not a lot more learning than like going to university, depending on what you want to do. So I think for certain paths, like if you want to go into deep tech, then university might actually be one of the best options for you in some cases, mm-hmm. because it has the pipeline into academia, which is one of the best ways to get very technical in some areas. Whereas you want to do business or entrepreneurship, you're probably better off actually learning from the environment of building a business. So that was kind of my logic for leaving and working on the company full time, is that I felt like I still think of this as my education phase of life. Just I'm getting an education through the company by working with people that are a lot more experienced than me and just observing like what types of things they do. And I thought that that would be more learning than what I would have gotten otherwise in school. So it just made sense for me to take a gap year this year.
And what about comparing like what you're learning in the business world versus a Penn Wharton student? What is your mindset on business versus what school would teach you? And, you know, the best business school at that. But like what would you say is the comparison?
Yeah, I think business school is very theoretical, and theory is almost useless in business. Like, I think the place where theory is very useful is when you're actually in the process of applying it, and then you can actually get a quick iteration cycle on like understanding the theory and where it actually applies and sort of feel out why the theory is useful and what intuition it's giving you. Theories are not BS. They're actually quite true and valuable, but you don't really get enough intuition or like understanding of them unless you actually have applied them and like felt out the boundaries of where they are and aren't useful. And so in business school and like undergrad business education, they kind of just teach you a bunch of theory that you never really use, some of which is kind of BS and some of which is good. And you never really get to like sort out what parts of it are good. Yeah, I think the best part of undergrad business education is when they do case studies, because that's essentially trying to like simulate a real world experience, which is kind of a testament to why actual real world experience is better. The best part of undergrad business school is literally trying to simulate actual experience. I wouldn't even call it just business. Starting a startup is a huge variety of different skill sets, and I guess you could group that into the category of business, but it's just building out an organization in so many different areas, operations and product and engineering and marketing, and like understanding the connections between all of these things and how they funnel into a common goal. And then all of those areas could also be considered subsections of a business major in college, but you just get a lot more practical experience by actually seeing it in the real world. And the other thing I would say is education is very dated. For example, if you just take the subset area of marketing, digital marketing and like social media marketing is the current thing, but like probably like a little niche class in business school, whereas actually that's all of the practical stuff you need to know in marketing. So it's very dated in that sense.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I was reading a business book from the 1980s. I think it's called High Output Management. It's written, totally forgetting the author. It's cool because it's like, it's the case studies. It's how Intel grew. It's how all of these different companies worked. But it still feels like when I think about my friends who are in the UNC Business School, like looking at their venture capital, PowerPoints, all these different things, I feel like you can just read this book and get a lot out of it. Like this 1980s book. It's not even what you're saying. It's not even that digital marketing. It doesn't have all these trends, but it has principles. Principles like the one that I've been really catching on is really focusing on the limiting reactant. So if you have a conveyor belt, if you're making an egg, the part that takes the most time is actually cooking the egg. So you might have a piece of toast or you might have a coffee, but the thing that matters is boiling the egg. That's the limiting part. And so there's all these principles that go through the book. I don't think school teaches principles in that way because you don't just test all these general things. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at. But I'm curious if there's a book or if there's mental models that have been really sticking from what you've seen and observed.
Yeah, I would say actually directly related to what you just said, the coolest book I found on this topic is called The Personal MBA. I think that's what it's called. And the idea of it is basically, and he says this in the intro, like people go through business school 4 or 5 years, they learn the same basic things, and he's basically boiled it all down into a book. And the premise of the book is that if you read this book, you'll learn all of the principles that they teach you in business school. And then people who have MBAs have gone and read the book and been like, yeah, I should have just read this. Like, this is actually all the practical stuff. So it's basically like an encyclopedia of business school. It's just a textbook of like everything you learn in business school, and it's all principles divided into like separate steps of making a business.
So, okay, I have a hypothetical question. If you could choose one person in the world to spend 2 weeks with, like you live with them, you can design the learning experience with them, who is the person you would pick? And I have follow-up questions.
I feel like there would be a lot of people depending on what I want to do.
Just pick one that you, like, you have to do it next week. Who would you want?
I mean, honestly, just because of how interesting the position he's currently in is, I would say Sam Altman. I think this is a very interesting point in time where the AI is a huge hype cycle, but I think unlike most hype cycles, this one actually has obvious massive legs. And then I think obviously OpenAI is also kind of at the core of driving forward the innovation there. And I think Sam Altman, he's obviously the CEO, and I think he's kind of at like an inflection point potentially in technology history. And also his story is cool too. He considers that he's never started a successful startup before.
Wow.
He did a startup in YC and it failed, and he became a partner at YC. So that's how he became successful. And then only now, like 20 years later, is he starting a startup.
So yeah, how much would you pay for 2 weeks of his time? Like, let's say you could buy him like a business class ticket. You live together because you want to spend as much time. And so you buy like a really nice apartment or house, and you can choose whichever city. But how much would you pay for like a 1 or 2 week experience dissecting his brain?
I feel like it's kind of priceless. I don't think I can put a price tag on it. And my willingness to pay is only relative to how much money I would have at that point.
Yeah. So I was thinking about this because I know someone who wants to do that, but with someone who's really good at sales. Let's say you're a business student and you're interested in sales, and you took the best salesperson at Microsoft. They've been in the sphere for 20 years, and like they're just really, really smart. Spending $20,000 2 weeks with them could be a potentially life-changing experience, and that's like a semester of university. So imagine if instead of spending that money on university, you spent it on like 8 really, really talented people that you can learn those skills from, and more importantly, the personal network. When I think about, okay, if I was to spend $20,000 right now, which would be a stretch for me, on someone who's really, really, really smart and could teach me something that's really impactful, that seems like a lot. But then again, it's so normalized to spend that money on an institution that they're teaching things that's 15 years old.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I think definitely that price would even be a steal. I feel like the hard thing there is not even the pricing, but just the people's availability and willingness to like actually want to spend time.
Yeah. So there's a quote, like, how you train is how you perform. And I've kind of been latching onto that for years and years and years. And it's like, okay, you have a minor inconvenience in your life. Are you going to cry about it? Are you going to sit down and, like, you know, let everything stop? Let me start by doing something. If I have this illness, or if I have something where I need to take an Advil to get better, just taking a moment and doing something that's hard every single day, it's like how you train is how you perform. And I think it'd be really interesting to see what successful, smart people, how do they act in the kitchen? Like when you order food at a restaurant, like what is their behavior to other people? I think those are the small things that really make a person make the most out of their 24 hours in a day.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think also one thing that I'm curious to see in people, and I think this is kind of a trait of extreme experts, is that they see past the surface level of what a field looks like into what I would call like the beauty behind a field. For example, it's really easy to conceptualize this with physics professors, and they see that their field is what underlies everything. Those types of insights, they're rare, but the people who are really deep in their fields often have them, either by selection because that's why they got into the field, or they've just spent so much time that they've gone really deep into it and realized. Those are also some of the most perspective-changing things that you could soak up from very experienced people.
Yeah, so I actually want to hear a little bit more about Third Web and also neuroscience. I know we were talking a few months ago about how you think that going to Penn would be a really great place to deepen your knowledge in neuroscience. How does that fit in the roadmap of Web3 stuff? I just want to hear the updates on Third Web.
Yes, this is a good question. So neuroscience for me is not necessarily the thing I want to do long term, but definitely an interest long term. As far as Web3 and neuroscience, I would say these fields are almost entirely unrelated. The way I think of Web3 and like working on third web is in comparison with neuroscience, which is currently like a deep tech, very science heavy, almost still research phase space. If you want to go work in that space, it's basically all research, pet projects, and like academia and stuff like that. If you go into the BCI space, neurotech, there's a little bit of shipping you could do with BCIs, but still, BCIs are very low resolution, and there's actually not much they can actually fully do yet. Whereas in spaces that are, they're not deep tech and they're not as sexy, like typical enterprise SaaS, and like I would say Web3 sort of fits in with this, but it's actually at a happy medium. The nice thing is it's way faster shipping cycles. You can actually ship products really quickly, which means that you get to learn how to build a company and like a product a lot faster. And those skills are universally valuable, which is what I've been focused on learning right now. And I think it's been great because, yeah, as I said, Web3 is like very fast iteration cycles. Yeah.
So it seems like the fast shipping cycles seem to be really exciting, and then that's the ultimate way for you to learn for company building. But what's your biggest critique of Web3?
Oh, there's so many. I mean, Web3 is just like any technology space that goes through a hype cycle. It's like the Gartner hype cycle diagram. You go through like the crest of hype, and there's so many use cases that people are purporting that it could be useful for. And then like things die down a lot, which I think Web3 has done a couple times recently, but this has been the biggest one and maybe the last one. It's become clear that like a lot of the stuff was noise. A lot of the companies get chopped out and like stuff gets chopped out. And the only thing that remains is the actual long-term value. So I'd say like as far as criticism, all of that 95% of stuff that was noise, I could give criticism on it. There's many reasons why a lot of the stuff shouldn't exist. But I think that now to like the next few years, the things that actually offer long-term value are like going to emerge as long-term obvious value adds. And then those will be the things that people start building around more.
What are some of the ones that you're excited about that not a lot of people are building on?
The most interesting things for me are one, digital ownership. I think that is just definitely going to be a thing, and I think that's definitely going to be built on Web3, and there's lots of reasons why it's valuable. And then digital currency, that's the simplest one. That also makes sense. Like digital programmable money makes sense. Money is honestly something that we don't really think about too much, and so it's not very sexy, but Web3 offers obvious value add to financial systems. And then ZK technology is one of the most promising things that it's not specifically just Web3, it just happens to be extremely useful for Web3. And so that type of technology is getting advanced a lot more than it would have otherwise, because ZK has existed for like 20 years, but nobody really touched it. But I think ZK is going to be the future of data security and data privacy as well.
Wait, tell me what ZK is. I've actually never heard of it.
Sorry, yeah, I should have clarified. ZK, zero knowledge proofs, is just a heavy computer science concept, which is basically a way to like prove something about some knowledge that you have without actually giving away the knowledge. And it happens to be useful in crypto because since all the blockchain data is public, all of your transaction info is public too, which is kind of a problem because you don't want people knowing how much you're getting paid and like what you're spending all your money on and stuff. So that's why ZK is super useful because it allows you to prove to the system that you're like actually following the rules of the blockchain, spending your money appropriately without everyone needing to know exactly where you're spending money. So it's basically like a complete necessity for privacy on the blockchain.
Yeah, so it's not a transparent ledger, it's like a translucent ledger.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Because I'm in Asia, I've been learning a lot about like the payments infrastructure because it's totally different. Everything is a QR code. Some places it's cash only, or it's just QR code. There's, I don't know if you've heard of Shopee or Lazada, all these like websites that you go on them and I get a headache because of all the colors and all the little items. I'm in Malaysia and I walk into a grocery store and it's like your brain explodes because right, you have like produce and then you have slippers and then you have snacks and then you have construction materials and batteries all within the same like 1 meter premise. It's a lot of stuff. And so you go to a food stall vendor in like Vietnam and there's 10 different QR codes you can sign, but then there's all this like cross-border transfers. I do a lot of transfers between Canada and the US and like there's no good cross-border transfer. I don't know if I'm just speaking from terrible experiences, but like I feel like there's so much opportunity there with international globalization, payments, blah blah blah. Like, please make international transfers possible or much easier.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's definitely one of the biggest use cases also. I think one place where I don't know if it will remain a long-term advantage is, and I think global payments sort of falls into this category, is people like how crypto has way less regulation around it. It also has way less barriers to doing stuff. So like you can send money more easily. And that's sort of related to the international transfer thing because normally with international transfer, you have SWIFT where you have to wait 3 days for shit, which is like really annoying. Whereas with crypto right now, just because it's completely unregulated and like also not relying on bank systems, you can do it really quickly. But then once regulation starts to get added, that advantage goes away. And I think it's sort of inevitable that like if it actually is going to succeed, then it's not going to be unregulated. Like it's still going to have the exact same regulations as normal money. So I wonder how many of those advantages will stick around versus go away.
Yeah, I have no idea. And I know there's a lot of skepticism, especially I went to a crypto like talk between Asia and Africa and a bunch of startups and a bunch of bank CEOs. And interestingly, like almost everyone was, they were pro-crypto if the central bank is involved and anti-crypto in terms of the hype cycle. And so it was really interesting, like the way they talked about the regulation and using the blockchain technology, but with a layer of regulation. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's super important. And there was actually, unfortunately, that was one of the interesting things Terra was doing. They didn't really have regulation, but they had monetary policy, basically the equivalent of the Fed managing the US dollar. So that was an interesting thing they were experimenting with. But unfortunately, Terra completely collapsed. So.
Yeah. Speaking of collapse and money, what is it like being in Silicon Valley with Silicon Valley Bank and all that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely affect pretty much the majority of people. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of spread its tendrils everywhere. But it seems like with the government announcing that they're going to back everything, it's kind of made it a little bit more stable. Yeah, I'm not sure how different people are handling the situation, but definitely seems to have massive effects. Yeah, I mean, I guess there's not much people could really do about it except just whatever the government opts to do is basically what's going to happen. I think, though, if the government didn't back everything, like people are speculating, and I think it's pretty obvious that it would have massive repercussions, not just the immediate effects of companies shutting down, but also like people's fear increasing for other trusted banks in general, which would be pretty bad.
Human fear can do so much damage. Just the fact that it can cause a bank run, or a lot of these systems just rely on, I keep my money there, but if I hear that Silicon Valley Bank is going to collapse, obviously I'm going to take my money out, but me taking my money out is just fueling the collapse. Human fear can guide so much chaos. And it's kind of like, how do you stay calm in these situations? And it's sort of a testament to the psychology portion of economics, not just the rational, the graphs and all those things. There's real human psychology behind all this stuff.
Super interesting there, because Silicon Valley Bank, this would have happened if there's a bank run at any point. The bank would have been illiquid or like potentially insolvent at each point. They're just relying on the fact that that's not going to happen. And that's not always the case, but in this case it is, because they have a lot of bonds where if they're allowed to mature, then they would be completely fine. But then like if everyone wants their money at first, they'll have to sell at a loss. So then they'll go from being illiquid to being insolvent, which is just the fact that that's completely on a whim, just based on people's fear. There's no like backstop for it. It's crazy.
Yeah, it was interesting. There's a couple of people who really predicted it well. People who were like, this is a bad sign, like based on what the CEO and stuff was saying before, take your money out. I wasn't really following until, you know, you get the Morning Brew newsletter and they're talking about SVB and all that stuff. But it really made me think about how important it is to have good judgment and good foresight, and how that like literally could save you in a situation like that. But imagine if you apply that same level of good judgment. And I don't exactly know how to get there, but I'm curious if you have any thoughts on what it means to be a good predictor in this world and a good contrarian. Like, I don't know, The Big Short, like the guy who made all the money on the 2008 financial crisis, like how to be someone who can look beyond the consensus of humans.
That's a good question. I think in this case, I'll add in having a good information diet and knowing where to look. Because I think in this case, a lot of the challenge is not just being able to analyze the bank statements and understand that they're in a sketchy scenario, but also if you're doing banking with them, like thinking to look at their statements and see where their money is. So like I think the steps that it would have taken to predict SVB, which probably the people who predicted it did go through these steps, is like they were curious about where SVB's money was. And then they identified that a lot of it was in like bonds, the price could go down. There, the difficulty is, one, caring enough to look into the backing of things. And I think that's a huge thing, even in The Big Short and other scenarios too. Caring enough to do the dirty work and like check what's actually going on behind the scenes and get the info. And then after that, I think it's more straightforward. I think it's difficult to teach being able to be a contrarian and like coming up with thoughts yourself, but it's just a combination of truly practicing and getting reps on being like first principled. I guess it's a combo of first principled thinking, which is difficult to teach, and also like ability to be skeptical of people with credentials.
Yeah. I like the word. I like information diet. And I think diet kind of implies this level of balance, and like there's bad things. But even if you eat a cake, that's not going to like throw your body down the drain. Like sure, you increase your sugar, you increase your dairy content, but like you can balance that, like if you do the right things. So I really like the use of the word diet. Maybe you notice this in the startup world, but it's less sexy than it actually sounds. Being a dropout, starting a startup, there's so much back-end work to running a company, running a business, and making stuff happen, and like so much of coding is debugging, like all these different things where it's not exactly super flashy work that could be in a movie. But we're so used to seeing the movie scenes of things that we assume life has to be that way, but life is actually quite boring on the day-to-day.
Yeah, I feel like startup is especially like that. I feel like over the past 5 to 10 years, especially during like the tech boom, that like the startup lifestyle has been idolized to the point where people like actively want to drop out and then like start a startup. And it's gone away the old mentality, which is that like it's actually insanely hard to start a startup and very risky.
Yeah. So what do you think about for you like starting a startup? I know you're like a founding engineer at Third Web, but how do you see that sort of evolving? So I'm curious what your trajectory might be.
Yeah. I don't want to over-optimize the path or like decide on a specific path that I want to take. I think Third Web is where I'm going to be like short to medium term, and that's because I'm learning a ton here. There's a lot of upside. And also like I think during a recession or like downturn like this, it makes you appreciate being part of like a really talented team a lot more than like going out and starting your own thing, because starting your own thing comes with initial dopamine hits and clout of like feeling great about raising money and like being a founder yourself and like being a CEO and stuff like that. But then like the dopamine hits don't really matter, of course. Like what matters is actually that you're building something good and that you have the resources you need to like succeed, and that becomes a lot more difficult during like a time like this. So I think it makes me appreciate the scenario and like the advantage of working with a lot of people who are very experienced as well. But I think after Third Web, I have a decision to make basically of, do I want to go back to college first or start something first, or how do I approach that? But I think the way I'll approach that decision is more so not do I want to start a startup or not, but what do I want to work on, or like what problem do I want to work on? Do I want to start a startup is like a question that has many prerequisites. The prerequisites are like, am I really technically competent in this area? And am I actually competent enough to have a good idea and like understand the space? And then that's the point where I would actually do that.
Yeah. Also like, who do you want to work under or work around? Like it's one of the reasons I just got a WeWork membership, because I was like, I can't be in libraries anymore. Like I can't do this hush library study culture. Like even if I am studying for school, like I want to be around people who are in a spot who are ambitious with fun colors on the walls, and like they're building things that they're really excited about. Like I want to be in those spaces, and I think that's something that I didn't really appreciate, because I kind of grew up with a stingy mindset on money, and now that I'm like out of the house and stuff, I'm like, okay, wait, spending money on my day-to-day work environment could actually fuel my productivity, and then like helps me create that cycle of getting some more money and whatever, like creating a life that is interesting. It's like, it's so important. And so I wonder if that's maybe an element to you, like, okay, who do you want to start a startup? Who are you starting your startup with? Who's going to be on your cap table? Or do you want to work for someone really smart on an early stage startup and all those different elements?
Yeah, definitely. That's a huge consideration. Like I actually think about that all the time, because I think that's one of the most, if not the most important thing, is who are you working with? So I think that's always something I'm thinking about, is who are people that I would feel like happy and like I think would be good people to work with. And I think that's what I'm getting right now, a lot more so than I would at Penn in SF. Like SF has great people, and especially at Founders Inc. where I work, everyone's building products, so I'm learning a ton there also.
So what's something people-wise that you're excited about in SF? So not work-related, what are some social things that you do, and how does that affect who you are as a worker?
The one thing about SF is there's not really anything that's not work-related. Almost the entire city is sort of built around startups and tech and work. It can be both a good and a bad thing. Like, on one hand, it's really energizing and cool to be around people who are so ambitious and interested in, like, technology and startups and things like that, where, like, you would never really find this in any other city in the world anywhere close to this. But then also it has, like, the other side of it where if you go to parties in SF, the classic joke is, like, everyone asks you, what do you do? As the icebreaker question. So it's like a double-edged sword.
So what's something you're really looking forward to do in the next 6 months? It can be an experience, it can be building something, anything.
Yeah, there's a few things. One is learning Rust well and building stuff in that, just because it's such an interesting programming language. And then also I would say there's this company called Buildspace where I work. It's a company just for like people to learn new skills and ship projects and like basically follow their dreams. And they're building an in-person school now in the building that I'm in. They basically pivoted their whole company into like an in-person school experience. I think that's going to be sick to see. Because I'm working right next to there, all these people, once the school's ready, are going to be coming in through there. I feel like it's going to be so cool to see like everyone from all different walks of life coming in to try to create new stuff. So I'm excited to see that.
Yeah. Any travel, any like bucket list items that you want to tackle in the next couple of months?
I probably should. I don't know how much I'm actually going to in my gap year, so I think I want to travel a bit in Europe, and then also I want to go to Singapore and Japan.
Definitely
But
Singapore. It's so great. Such a
yeah,
cool.
ever since I read Lee Kuan Yew's book, then
Yeah.
I just like have really wanted to go to Singapore. But what do you think have been your like biggest takeaways from all the travel you've done recently, especially in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, okay, I think Singapore has been like sort of the coolest. They have like a simulation for Singapore 70 years from now with airflow, directionality. I think people are so aware of the government. They're aware of how smart the government is. Like getting a job in the government is considered top tier. If you have a government job, you have made it. You are a brilliant genius. And that's really interesting. Like it kind of shows this like competency within it. Having a government that is really what's the word? Like you almost want to put it on a pedestal, because if that's the thing that you're going to pay your taxes to, if that's the thing that's going to run your society, like you want to look up to it. You don't want to look down to it. I think the other thing is that people are so aware of all these different government agencies. Like I couldn't name three acronyms of the Canadian or American government. These are countries that I've lived in. For Canada, I lived for 18 years. In the US, I've lived for 2 years. I could not name like more than three ministries or departments. People in Singapore like are constantly talking about the government. All these different elements, the ICA, MINDEF, blah, 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 ASTAR, like the government research agency, like everyone just kind of knows stuff. And like that to me is so interesting. How powerful are your acronyms that they spread to just like regular old citizens? And then I also think there's like principles of cleanliness that I've really appreciated. But other countries like Indonesia and Malaysia have been really, really cool just to see like how different culture can be, and how you could be literally like 100 kilometers away and like you cross the border from Singapore into Malaysia and you are crossing the border. Like it is a different place. Stuff is so much cheaper. Streets aren't as clean. There's not as much urbanization, but there's a little bit more like family and culture, whereas Singapore is very much like type A society. So it makes you think Singapore is not best for everything. Like there are places that are more like family friendly, or like depending on your stage of life and the type of person you are. We are definitely the type of people to like thrive in a Singapore or Japan, but there's also people that would really thrive in France, which has really great social security and like tons of strikes. At least that's the thing that I'm a little bit reflecting on. Like society is not meant for everyone, and I don't know. I'm just loving seeing new things and exploring. And I think if you can during your gap year, totally try your best. Once you take the flight, like you can live in Southeast Asia for pretty cheap, $20 a day.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's another type of perspective shift, I guess. Seeing all the things you take for granted in your home country and then how different they can be. Like, for example, the one that stood out the most to me while you were saying that is the concept of thinking of the government, respecting the government, and thinking of them as like smart and competent and efficient. It's like, I can't imagine. Like, in the US, you think of like the best companies, you think of them as like super efficient and meritocratic, and like the people that work there are really smart. And then when you think of the government, you think inefficient, slow, mostly incompetent.
Exactly.
And it's crazy to reverse that, but also it feels like a difficult problem to get government to actually be like efficient like that because of the scale of it. I mean, I guess it comes out in like how efficient the country is and like all the infrastructure and stuff like that.
Yeah, but also like the difference is that the US has over 300 million people and Singapore
Yeah.
has 5. You only have to control so much, and so for example, there's not really like opposition parties in Singapore. Like there are technically, but they can't advertise themselves in the media. And the idea is eliminate human waste. You don't want to waste human resources by humans fighting against each other. You just want to get the smartest people in the room, and it's all about like the meritocracy of the mind, not the policies. Whereas in a lot of other places, especially when it's a two-party system, like you kind of it's like you're shouting against each other and you're trying to just get seats in power and like color the map in a certain way.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because it shows the efficiency of centralization in some ways.
Yeah. I think it's really hard to build for the future when the people who are in power are not the like smartest graduates. They're not the ones that have the best foresight into the future. They're the ones that can win the popularity contest of the mass public, and the mass is not on average like really educated on like the future.
Yeah, it's interesting how that can be redefined in different areas. Like, I think one of the biggest opportunities career-wise, like, if you just want a really obviously extremely valuable career, it's going to be like tech X law slash government. Being the person that actually understands that stuff and is able to regulate it, because the government is inevitably going to need to regulate this stuff and be like heavily involved with it, has like close to zero understanding of it. It's just like so scarce anyway, because most people in tech don't even think to go into that type of intersection, that it's just like
Yeah.
such a
And likewise, those people in law don't do that. Like, a lot of people don't want to go into law and technology. Like, those are kind of two separate things. And so you have a shortage of patent lawyers, and then you have this new, you know, new revolutionary change that's going to happen, and it could provide a lot of value in law in general. And I think that, like, legal tech side is going to be really interesting, but there's totally, like, it's a niche area.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, even in every deep tech area I can think of, like, it's almost like a blocker. In crypto, obviously, with regulation, like, the people who are the crypto lawyers are going to have so much leverage. But even, like, in AI, too, we're going to need regulation. In neurotech, we're going to need regulation. Like, it's, like, such an important area. It's kind of interesting how under, like, indexed it is as far as, like, people actually doing that stuff.
I have no idea why. Maybe because, like, law is kind of like this conventional, straightforward path. Like, I mean, I don't know how much more efficiently you can do law school. Like, 3 years to become a lawyer, like, that seems pretty decent, like, in terms of ROI to me, like, the education and stuff that you get. But I guess it feels a little bit disjointed to, like, the computer hacker, basement, Stanford, startup vibes, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I think also the people who go into it often aren't thinking about stuff like that. Because of how deeply integrated it is with the political system, and, like, politics tends to be very separate from, like, technology and startups in America right now, that those two things are very far apart.
Yeah, I mean, part of it for me is I don't even know what continent I want to live on, and so I don't want to, like, study the law of a country that I'm, you know, like, I don't, yeah. I'm not committing yet. I don't know if you feel, I mean, Canada's great, but, like, maybe not business forward. I don't know if I want to live in America. I don't know if I want to live in Europe. I don't know if I want to live in Africa or Asia or Australia or whatever. Like, I'm so open to the world. It's like, hey, maybe let's not become a lawyer yet.
Yeah. I wouldn't specifically maybe invest in the time to become a lawyer, but I do think the law education, I suspect, like, completely speculation, I would suspect that it covers mostly a large breadth of stuff, and then you only, like, niche down into specific country law and, like, a few classes or different areas. Like, yeah. It's probably a large portion of it, but I feel like the more broad side of it is probably super interesting and applicable as well. Plus, like, if you become a lawyer in one country, I would guess that it would be, like, cross-applicable to, in, like, some ways to a lot of different areas.
Yeah. Like, okay, let's say you become a lawyer in XYZ country, and you, like, do that. Like, even if you go and you want to start a startup and it doesn't have anything to do with what you practice, like, you still took something away. And I think that's what's really important. There's, like, so many different paths to get to the same goal. And, like, the conventional one is often handed to you on a silver platter. But there's so many ways that you can achieve something. And so, likewise, within an experience, there's so many things that you can take away. Because the way you spend your time over, like, a 3-year period, you're just going to learn so much. Even if it feels like the same thing every day, like, you are building every single day. And I think taking that mindset of, okay, I can get to this goal through many different paths, I can dissect what I got from this experience in many different ways. And so just kind of doing something is better than doing nothing, because you can dissect something, but you can't dissect nothing.
Yeah, I agree. And also, one of the things I've noticed, like, related to that, is when you're doing an experience, you can get so much out of it. And so it doesn't really matter that it's, like, specifically exactly tied to, like, what you want to do next. Mm-hmm. I think the more high-impact thing is understanding how it fits into, like, your further goals, even if it's not the exact perfect thing. And the reason I say that is because it's almost all about framing. If you're doing something at the moment that feels, like, completely separate from what your long-term goal is, that could even be kids who think college is useless, but they're in college anyway. If you make it feel useless, it feels, like, horrible, and you feel, like, demotivated doing something. Whereas if you find ways to, like, fit it into your future goal and make it connect the two things, it makes it so much more purposeful, and it gives you so much more motivation. But what I'm saying is, like, I think that you could do this for anything, and it's very productive to do that. Because, mm-hmm. as you said, you learn so much from doing stuff. It's almost inevitable that you're going to learn stuff that will be useful for your, like, further goal if you frame it in, like, the proper way to do that.
Yeah, I actually think this is a really great point. Kind of like, okay, if you start by assuming that everything is abundant, you can find something within there. But if you start by assuming that there's nothing there, like, you're not just going to magically find something, because you're not looking for it. You're not allowing yourself to find that.
Yeah, exactly. It's also like what you said about the paths thing. Do you think about your goal as there's a single path to your goal and you're not on it right now? Or do you think about your goal as, out of whatever you're constrained to right now, there's many paths that lead towards that goal? And so you're not concerned about, like, switching your current path, but figuring out which of the paths in front of you leads to that goal. And, like, basically the default assumption is that there always is a path in front of you that leads to your goals. You just have to choose the right one.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I don't know if I talked to you about this, but when I climbed a mountain recently, like, you spend so much time going downhill. And it's like, what the hell? Like, I'm supposed to be climbing up the mountain, but you have to go downhill to contour around. And so it's like, okay, this step might not actually, like, it might literally be the opposite of the direction you're trying to go, but it's part of the process. And so you have to allow yourself to go up and down, but just, like, to believe and just, like, to try things. And maybe you realize you don't want to climb that mountain, you want to climb the other one instead. Allow that to be a takeaway as well.
Yeah, I agree, definitely. I feel like I felt this at different parts of my life too, at least in hindsight. Like, I've realized how things that I wouldn't have thought at the time would, like, lead to specific goals I had actually were, like, in the path that ended up playing out, extremely important to things like that I wanted actually happening. So that gave me that perspective.
First of all, I want to hear about your information diet. But second of all, like, what are the things that make you really happy in terms of, like, the information you consume and the way you look at the world with abundance?
I would say slightly related. I think one of the biggest things for me is, like, when I'm reading or learning, the feeling of, I would call it integration. And I think this increases a lot as you, like, learn more and more and more stuff about just a variety of topics. When you make a connection between things, and this, like, only ever happens if you increase your information just for the sake of, like, wanting to learn and not for, like, specific optimization, you start to make connections between things that are, like, very far apart. And often the connections are, like, areas that really wouldn't have made the connection, and nobody would have, unless you, like, had the random experience from another area. But, like, it never would have been taught to you that way. I think that's amazing, because that's where unique insights often come from. So I think those connections are great, but also I think they solidify your understanding of core principles of different areas. Because when you're learning, basically I think of learning as creating an index of, like, each different area you're learning about. When you store data in a database, you want to be able to, like, search it effectively. In order to search it effectively, you need to, like, pull out the key properties that you care about searching through, and that's called an index, so that you can search through it quicker without having to go through the whole thing. And so when I think about learning, I think about when you boil an entire area, like, let's say an entire book, into, like, a few key insights and principles, and then those key insights and principles are what you can use to compare it to, like, other things. So then, like, if you read other stuff that matches with that, then you'll start to, like, draw connections between those two things. The process of boiling things down into principles and then seeing connections between all the different principles that, like, you've learned about. It's like a subconscious thing. It's not, like, an intentional thing, but the feeling of that is just so satisfying and also very, like, high value.
It feels like solving a puzzle, kind of.
Yeah.
Like, it's a puzzle you didn't know that you were going, but you're like, oh my God, I connected the dots. Like, this is so much fun.
Yeah, I agree.
What about some things that you stopped doing and that those, like, stopping doing those things brought you a lot of satisfaction, happiness, or productivity?
Ooh, well, this is kind of a classic one, but I deleted a ton of different stuff that made me satisfied. So, like, TikTok's so addicting. I love it with all my heart. It gives me so much dopamine. Yeah, so that was too addicting, so I deleted it. That made me satisfied. And then also, like, I just ended up deleting, over the course of the next few months, pretty much almost all social media. Not from, like, a perspective of, like, I want to delete social media to be disciplined, but just I feel like it was giving me such a dissatisfying information diet. Your dopamine level readjust to, like, whatever is the highest dopamine thing that you have, like, easy access to. And so, like, when you have social media like that, the default thing you do in, like, so much time, it just sucks up, is, like, you just click on your phone and go click on those things. Because those things give you a certain level of dopamine, then, like, if I had the option of doing that versus, like, reading, I would probably just click that, just because it's, like, slightly higher dopamine. But now that those options aren't there, it makes it a lot easier to just randomly pick up a book in your free time, or, like, do other way more productive things that are way lower dopamine in your free time. So I think that's also a very positive benefit of that.
I put this in words the other day, and I was like, that's a good sentence. Like, you can watch a movie when you're tired, or you can, like, be on your phone when you're tired, but you don't really read a book when you're tired. But you can read a book and become tired. And I think that's such a very underrated thing. Going to bed tired, because, like, you just did a bunch of stuff during the day, and, like, that's what humans did when we didn't have this, like, crazy society with skyscrapers and internet communication. Like, we worked our entire day, whether we were mothers, whether we were caregivers, whether we went out and hunted, whether we went out and gathered. We spent our day getting things to survive, and now we don't. Like, we just, you go to the store, you pay $5, you get, like, a noodle salad, whatever. Like, you just kind of, you gotta exist. And I think with that, like, we've lost the, like, satisfaction of going to bed being exhausted, and I think that's something that I'm striving to do recently, and it's so much fun.
That's really interesting. I like that a lot, actually. I think, on one hand, yeah, it also helps with sleep, but also, like, I feel like it's a good metric for the day, because I so much goes into that. Like, I think if you made that into a simple formula of some amount of exercise or, like, physical exertion to make you tired, plus some level of, like, mental exertion and, like, productivity that like combines into that. It's just a great basic metric to quantify your day.
I completely agree. For example, like I think everyone kind of has a social battery. I think some people less. I have definitely have a social battery, but that social battery adjusts. Like if I'm at an event and I'm like in a stage of my life where I have so much stuff and I'm like a little bit stressed out, going to an event would be very exhausting. However, I still think it's important to like build your network, build relationships and have meaningful conversations, like whether you're busy or stressed or anxious or whatever. Going to some place and being tired after is actually a good indicator that like, you took out what you could from there. And like maybe that's 1 hour, maybe it's 10 hours, like whatever it is, like I think it gives you at least a sense of accomplishment. And I think that's really important for like giving yourself a little bit of fuel to have a good night rest and start again.
Yeah, I agree. So do you feel like first, like if you aren't tired, then you haven't gotten what you wanted to out of the day?
Yes. And I think social media makes you exhausted in a way of like, it's not satisfying because you know you did nothing. Like you literally sat there and consumed information. Like maybe you'll trick yourself because you watched like a news reel and now you can like, in two bullet points, talk about one piece of news. But otherwise, you know that you did nothing during that time. But I think like when you read a book or when you like do something that exerts energy, like you feel exhausted in a good way. And it almost makes me feel like we need a different word to distinguish that. That's one of the things, like one of the habits that I've gotten is that I try to use my social media in like a very deliberate way. So for example, what is the purpose for this app? Okay, we're going to keep it there. So either don't use it, or if you use it, I'm going to delete it. So it's kind of like there's like two sides of me using it. And that's something that's been really helpful. But it takes a lot of discipline.
Yeah, I agree. I do the exact same thing with things that I want myself to do or like habits I want myself to form. I think of the point where I have control over it is not the point of using my willpower to like choose to do or not to do something. But it's the point where I make it either easy or difficult for me to do something. So what I mean by that is, every time you see Instagram, are you using your willpower to like not click it or to click it? Or do you just delete Instagram and you're never going to see it? Or it's the same thing with the concept of like sleeping with your phone not in your room. You could either sleep with your phone on your bedside and like tell yourself, I'm going to be disciplined, I'm not going to look at my phone in the morning. Or you could just literally not have it nearby and like not even have the option.
Yeah, it's not about proving your strength. I think it's more like the outcome. Like, what are you going to do? And, like, why make life harder? Like, there's already so many variables. There's, like, so many things going on, especially, like, in the morning, like, waking up. Like, your monkey brain will just always be like, oh, I want more sleep. You know, no lions chasing me right now. Like, no, there's no reason. Like, I have food in the fridge. And I think that's one of the things that really stops us is that we have so much comfort that there's, like, no reason to get up. Unless it's, like, this morning I had a flight. And so it's like, okay, I'll get up at 5 a.m. Like, that just makes sense. And then you get up and you're like, okay, well, there's no snoozing now because then I'm going to waste money and, like, all these things. And I have places to be. I think we've lost that.
Yeah, I agree. I'm a victim of this at the current moment. I'm trying to reset my sleep schedule. And
yeah.
Like for the past, I had massive jet lag like a couple days ago when I came, and now I experienced that this morning. Like I was just chilling in bed. I always just wake up. I'm just like, whatever. I'll go back to sleep for a bit. But like I don't want to. But I don't have a specific thing or enough will to like specifically get myself out of bed. So then I just end up waking up late, and I'm like, oh my god, what did I just do?
Yeah, I think stuff like that. I also was in this sort of phase of that recently, but I need to start having a book next to my bed. Because that's what I really enjoy, because then I can, like, think about things during the day, have really good shower thoughts. That's actually one of the things that I've started doing is, like, just not bringing my phone into the washroom at all. So that, like, anytime I'm in there, it's, like, just, like, thinking, like, whatever. I like taking showers, but I've been doing cold showers, you know, challenge myself, all those, like, little things. And it's kind of like, if you have these small milestones throughout the day, you kind of remember to do hard things. Like, I'm choosing a little bit of discomfort when I shower. Or, like, when I say no to cake, like, I'm choosing balance for my body or these things.
Yeah. Also, you said shower thoughts there, and I feel like so many of my ideas have come like specifically in the shower. Like I would say like greater than 50% of all of my ideas have come in the shower.
How long are your showers?
I do. I take long showers. Like I take like 10-minute, 15-minute showers.
Okay, people would call that short. I also do 10-minute, 7 to 10-minute showers. But
okay.
I actually had one thought recently, and it's kind of been developing, and it's on GPT and like just in general like artificial intelligence models. And it's a comparison to organic food. And I want to hear your thoughts. Okay, so AI is going to get smarter and smarter. Like, what are humans going to do? Soon, an AI will be just as qualified as a daycare instructor, which is like a very huge, or a kindergarten teacher. At least that's the idea. There's still a part of me that wants to believe that there's a human intuition. And there's like a human element that is going to be really valuable. And I'm not sure what that is. I sort of thought about organic food. most of our food was organic. We didn't use pesticides. We didn't use any of these things until very recently, until mass production became really important. Then we started making GMO foods, and that like solved a lot of issues. And we started adding all these foods and food engineering, and it became really good on a mass scale. But from there, we realized, like, oh my God, like what we were doing with organic food was actually much better for our body. And we only realized 10 years after we started implementing all these like food processes and changing like the way we regulate food. And then now there's like, and now the food that we were originally having, organic food, is so much more expensive, partially because of the way it cultivates. It doesn't solve that mass production problem. But it's like we realized after we added all these technologies that there was actually value to what we were doing before, despite it being less intelligent or less advanced. But anyway, I'll shut up now. What do you think of my comparison?
I'll play devil's advocate on that. Like, yeah, I think I also want to believe that there's unique things that humans do. And I think at the current moment, there's like a lot of things that humans do that GPT bots can't do. GPT and like LLMs in general, once you know exactly what you want to do, they can do it really well. But like humans are needed for like analysis and synthesis and stuff like that, which is kind of like what you were talking about. But I think also in that scenario, the more important thing is humans come with the optimization function. Humans come with what we want to do and why we want to do it. And then we use AI as like a tool in the same way that computers were a tool to like accomplish that. And so that's like something that's clearly a difference right now. AI can only be good if it's achieving a specific goal. So AI is going to be, I think, basically perfect at the doomer scenario is like AI is going to be great at achieving any goal. And like it's going to be up to humans to determine what the goals are. That kind of pushes us into like a very niche space, which is figuring out what specific things we want to do. I've increasingly been pushed to the side of like anything that I think is like a, this is what humans are going to do and AI won't really do this, is probably not actually accurate. Like I think, I don't see any reason why AI can't do pretty much all of this stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you're right. And part of me, like, you know, the Tim Urban graph of like the stairs, and it's like, okay, humans, and then dogs are a step below where they can't fathom our consciousness, but we can fathom theirs, and how AI is going to be a step above humans. And like, that's totally possible. I guess it's like, okay, how will human society run? Just to give humans purpose. I think the way human society is going to run, like, is going to have to really adapt. And maybe we'll just have to pretend that like our work is meaningful, even though the AI can do it 10 times better.
Yeah, I mean, I think even in that statement, like, I don't think it's necessary for our work to be better than AI for it to be meaningful. Like, honestly, it's already sort of arbitrary that we derive meaning from our work because it is, like, achieving the goal that we want it to. If AI does achieve what all the techno-optimists think it will, then society is going to basically shift completely. The final optimization function is, like, human purposefulness, human satisfaction, and that comes from, like, whatever arbitrary things it comes from.
Do you think the developed world is doing worse on the human purpose function? Because like when you think about like depression rates and mental health, that seems to be a very Western discussion. This unhappiness epidemic seems to be concentrated in very specific circumstances. What do you think of that? Like the optimization of the purpose function and how it kind of relates right now to the way the world's structured.
Yeah, I think honestly that optimizing the purpose function is a very first world thing. You can only really start thinking about that and even feeling, I think maybe even biologically feeling that type of thing when like your base needs are met, where the difference between first world and third world is, of course. And I feel like a lot of people in third world just adopt values that don't even let them think about or care about stuff like that because they understand that like if you need to grind to live, then it's probably not remotely on your mind that you're feeling a little bit sad.
Yeah, honestly, like I've been watching a lot of documentaries recently and like just seeing the way that people live their lives. Think about the mental strength. I was in Vietnam recently and like the mental strength of so many people, like just seeing the way that like circumstances like lent their lives. Yeah, I think you're right. Like they just don't have, there's not a lot of time to really reflect on happiness and even identity, like who you are and like having those identity crises. Like it doesn't matter. Like you have to work on the rice field. Or you have to like do these things. And so it's very much a privilege.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I guess it's actually just completely in line with Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Like it's like you get the baseline needs done. And then you can finally think about self-actualization and maybe all these ones that we're talking about. Obviously, purposefulness fits into that. And then also maybe, like, your mental health, happiness and stuff all fits into, like, the top.
Okay, I have just a couple more questions. I know we're, like, totally just jamming out a lot. But how do you section your time in a week?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't have anything too crazy here. But in the morning, I always meditate and read when I wake up. I found that for all the habits I want to do, they're only going to get done if I do them like immediately in the morning, right when I wake up, because it's like a definite time. After that, there's a very high chance they won't get done. Yeah, I always read and meditate in the morning, and then like when I was going to the gym, which I should get back to, but I haven't, I would do that in the morning as well. And then after that, I go to work for like pretty much most of the day on the weekdays. And this is, I feel like my answer is gonna be bad because like it's so like my schedule changes so much. So I'll work during the day. That even that looks very different from day to day. Like sometimes we'll be coding for like a super long time, or like sometimes we'll have a ton of calls, or like we'll always chill in the middle of the day also, or at the end of the day and like game for a bit sometimes. And then after that, I go back, and then at that point I do my own creation times. That's either working on coding projects, ideas that I've had that I want to work on, or writing, which is like the current thing I'm doing. Like writing is so satisfying to me. Yeah, I have a lot of unpublished stuff, and then yeah, just like writing about new ideas or thoughts that I've had, trying to explain things.
And do you have a creative space? Like, do you do this in the Founders Inc. office? Do you like to go to a coffee shop? What's your space to do it?
I always go home, and it's just like wherever I'm staying at the time, and then I go to the kitchen or like the dining area.
Do you like being interrupted?
I actually don't mind. The thing that I don't like to do, so I don't mind being interrupted and talking. The thing that I really don't like is having to like fully context switch and like do something else. Like I hate having calls in the middle or like having to like go somewhere or stuff like that. I mean, I feel like it's like a common downfall of engineer brain or like creative brain, because it's like you get into flow state. Like I always get into flow state when I'm writing or coding or something like that. I could just sit there for like hours while I'm in flow state and just keep going. It also has like a bad side to it, which is you won't get up to do anything. So like if you left me to my own devices, I could like wake up in the morning, especially at home, have an applesauce or something, like not that much, and just code for like hours straight, just like sit there and like not eat or anything. But
It's such a common thing. Like I'm so lucky. When I was a kid, like I had my mom like bring me fruit to my room or like food, because otherwise, it's too like when I was in like my very like 10 hour a day working era, I would just totally forget to eat. It's so inconvenient too. Like you eat and then you get
yeah.
tired and the whole. I want to become like a 2 meal a day person, but
Ooh, I would love
I'm
that.
like you wake up, you have a good meal, and then like you work out or something, like burn it off, and then you like work, and then you have a great meal to end your day, and then you eat carbs at the end of the day and you go to bed tired. Sounds like a good.
Oh, that would be amazing. But if it was just beginning and end, that would make it so much simpler.
Yeah. So one big question that I have is leveraging the TCAS network in San Francisco. Maybe, I don't know, maybe one or two things that you really took away from TCAS that you're kind of thinking about right now, because I think there's some really good takeaways from the program.
I think one of the biggest things that's kind of underrated, or like I didn't really think about it, but it's so relevant now, is that no matter where you go, like if it's a big city, there's probably going to be like a good amount of TKS kids there you can hang out with, which are kind of like similar brand. But also, any other event I go to in the city, there's probably also some TKS people there too. So it's very nice.
Yeah, it's like a community connector. Are there any things that you really took away from the program that, whether it's like a saying or a mindset or like a technological trend, like is there something that you've been chewing on recently?
Totally not even intentional by me. TCAS was even the first thing that made me think about an information diet and also fix my information diet. Because Velocity had all these requirements of videos that you'd have to watch that were all like good, high value, like learning videos, it changed my YouTube feed. All of those started to pop up, and like I actually watched a ton of stuff that I would never have seen before if TCAS Velocity requirements didn't change my YouTube feed.
Love it. So, are you proud of your YouTube feed now?
I mean, I haven't gone on YouTube in a while, but my YouTube feed has kind of gone to shit again. But my good feeds are like the books that I read and like the articles that I read more so than YouTube.
What's your source of articles or newsletter? I'm becoming a newsletter grandma. That's my new goal in life.
Just specific like Medium and Substack that I see, or like the way that I actually get reading is through crosslinks. If I'm reading like an article or like a post, and then that thing references other things, or I get all my book recommendations from giant book lists where it will be like someone I think is cool that has like a gigantic book list, and I'll like look through the ones that they think are the best about like different topics, and then
Sure.
I'll just like add those to my book list.
Love it. Is your book, my book list is incredibly long, and I'm sure yours is as well.
Yeah,
Because, yeah.
mine is infinite and
Isn't that
yeah, unfortunately.
interesting? Like, it's probably something you're never going to finish, but it still feels like a
Yeah.
worthwhile pursuit to add it to the list.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you want a library in your future house?
Oh yes, definitely. That's my number one. I feel like library, not just like the books, but
Library.
also it just sets the mood. Like I feel like library is one of the best visually appealing and like homey rooms too.
Yeah, so okay, you have 5 rooms, not including bedrooms. What are they in your house?
Kitchen slash eating area. I count that as one room.
Sure.
I don't even know if I need 5 rooms. To be honest with you, like the rooms that I need is like a bedroom with like a meditating area, maybe a meditation room. I'll put that as a separate room. And then like the kitchen eating area, and I guess a living room to chill and stuff like that. That's all I need.
Where's the
But
library?
yeah, I mean, library is an add-on. That's if I'm like really chilling. Then I would have like a library with like a sitting area, and it has to have a fireplace. I actually have a Notion page. It's my AB page. That
Yeah.
stands from Thealin. It's
Yeah.
AB stands for after bag. It's from Thealin and Vish. But on that page, it's like all the stuff I want to do after I get to a certain level of success that I've set for myself. And one of them, there's actually a screenshot of like this sick YouTube thumbnail I saw. It's like a specific library that was on a YouTube thumbnail for like meditation music, but it's just so nice. And I want like a room like that in my house.
Oh my God, I love that. I think for me, it's like I want to have amazing places to host people. I love dinner parties and I love just like let's gather and have like a really wholesome chat. I think spaces, whether it's your home or your office building, like that really just defines the culture of what you live in. And I think like having a meditation room, like especially if you put a lot of money and energy into it, like you'd feel a little bit guilty about not meditating because you're not using that room. And it's kind of like a fun way to enforce the type of person you want to be.
Yeah, definitely. That's something I've been thinking about more recently is physical spaces, because I actually went to a TKS dinner recently and there's this really interesting dude there named Steve. But like one of the things he's done is he made a cabin retreat place around Toronto, and like
Oh.
he was thinking a lot about physical spaces and like the implications of them, and he designed like this whole experience around it, which is super cool. So that made me think a lot more about how important physical spaces actually are.
Yeah, I also think digital spaces. How many tabs do you have open at different times? How are your folders organized? How often do you go back and maintain them? I think that's something that, like, living on my own for the first time in like the last couple of years, you have to maintain your space. Like, it's not like, okay, you move in, you have your furniture all nicely. Like, stuff gets, you need a vacuum. You need to, like, clean the surface. You need to do the dishes. And I think we kind of forget that on digital spaces. Like, we make a really pretty Notion table and it has all the filters and all the things. And, like, you want to add to it and it's, like, really cool. And you can post a screenshot to Twitter, like, look at how organized I am. But, like, if you're not going back and, like, vacuuming and dusting it and, like, adding air freshener, like, that system is going to die and rot, just like your physical spaces would if you didn't maintain them. But it's
Yeah.
less tangible, so you can't really, like, see that as much.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, okay, I don't know, is there any like last topics to cover? I mean, we've talked for so long now, but thanks so much for being so down to just do this and jam out.
Thanks for catching up with us. That was Making It Real by TKS, and I'm your host, Isabella. I hope you have a crazy audacious week, and I will see you next time.